Hello there, you awakening wonders. Thanks for joining me on Stay Free with Russell Brand. Wherever you happen to be watching this, maybe you're watching it on YouTube, the whole show will be exclusively on Rumble and you ain't going to want to miss it because we're talking about Big Pharma today, Biden's broken promises to lower drug prices. And, excuse me, sorry about that. I just ate a burrito.
I know.
What about my broken promises not to burp on camera? This is such a beautiful bit of footage of Biden being so sanctimonious and sincere about he's just a regular guy affected like all of us by those bloody fat cats in Big Pharma. Sort of never mentioning that he's the president of the United States during all of it. It's fantastic. You're going to love it. Also, we've got so-called journalist Matt Taibbi on the show talking about the war on free speech. I'm so excited to speak to him. I've not spoke to him since he had that. Is it Debbie Wasserman Schultz, that woman in Congress? This is my time. This is my time. So I'm going to say that to him during the conversation.
You should.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask him a question. Like,
you should hold that up and say that.
I'm going to go, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. All right, Matt, tell us exactly why you appeared as a Republican witness and how the issue of free speech transcends normal political boundaries, because ultimately it will always affect all of us because we don't know who's in authority. We go, okay, so me and I'm going to just go, it's my time, it's my time, it's my time. And then implicit, it's my time to shine like the girl boss queen I am deep down. Once we're only on Rumble, we're going to be talking about, as usual, some new data on vaccine side effects. Can you euphemistically tell me what that is?
No.
Because it's not allowed on YouTube.
Right.
Can't even even couched in euphemism.
About pregnant women.
Oh, no! Do you mean to say, Gareth, that when they were trialing those medications, they weren't pregnant women going, yeah, you can test that medication on me and my unborn?
This is the bit where we don't.
Okay. Okay, yeah, we can't talk about that, but on Rumble, we can. That's why we're on Rumble, for free speech that will unite us all. The good news is Hillary Clinton is running. Have a look at this.
Oh my God.
What is it?
It's Hillary Clinton. She's running.
What?
What?
Hillary. What is the whole tone of this piece of propaganda? This is obviously a piece of propaganda of some kind. It's one of those probably sort of an online education facility of some description that hasn't gone to the trouble of investigating Hillary Clinton's
or
past.
What young people are like.
Hey, I'm a young people person, so look at me. You know what I love? Hillary Clinton. She's so cool and down with the cats and kids. It's such a terrible misstep, a misinterpretation of what reality is. And I suppose that's the fundamental problem, isn't it, with contemporary politics, is they live in a different reality. They live in a different America, so their rhetoric and their presentations of what America's meant to be like seems like some sort of vacuous Aldous Huxley-esque phatic impersonation of reality where everyone's, what are you all upbeat about? Is it the poverty? Is it the desperation? Is it the opioid crisis? Is it the endlessly inculcated division that we're all experiencing? It's all of that. And have you heard? Hillary's running. That's not exciting. It's not like a Harry Styles album or a new form of skunk. It's not going to cause any excitement in the corridors of academia, is it?
Running again?
I know, I heard that's so crazy. This is wild. She's running again.
But it's not wild at all, is it? Because how many times has she tried now? It's just, the response would be, really? Again? Why?
You know that woman who spent her whole doggone life trying to impose herself on us, whether it's by crushing the aspirations of Bernie Sanders, who was a populist representation of a traditional leftist movement, or whether it's sort of clambering over the complications, should we call him, in her marriage, or whether it's starting up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Making up lies about Russia and Donald Trump.
Lying about Russia and Donald Trump. You know that sort of relentless force for power that potentially has got all sorts of expressions in forms that would we discuss that ever only on Rumble? Like some of the, should we say, the statistically high number of people that have taken unusual decisions after knowing the Clintons. Should we just call it that? Is that euphemistic enough?
Well done.
Yeah. Hey, look who's running again. Look who's running people into an early grave. It's the Clintons. Again, that could just be euphemistic.
Yes, and it was.
It was. Not only could it be, it would it be. It was. So, and look at this now. Now we've got the bit of like Hillary Clinton. The whole joke of this is predicated on, she's not running for office like she usually is. She's literally running down a corridor in some little dolly boots. And we're meant to think that's somehow adorable when it's a war criminal. You think that's actually Hillary Clinton's kicky legs?
Well, if it was, that would be the most authentic part of this entire thing. So let's hope.
If that was Hillary Clinton's actual tootsies, toes, toenails and soles of her feet, bunions, corns, etc. And hey, we all get older. Like, then that would be the only authentic thing.
Maybe that's why they did it. They're like, well, 5% of this is actually real. So we can stick with that.
Do you know what was real about this video? Go on. Those were her feet. What's not real is anything else. The enthusiasm of the young people, the claims that this is a legitimate political voice rather than an institutional, like in a sense, the epitome of the political class. This is not about Hillary Clinton as a person. It's not, because I know Hillary Clinton is a mother and a wife and in some ways like has succeeded in, you know, the narrative of a woman succeeding in a male world is, I think, a significant and important narrative and I think worthy of celebration. But what also has...
That she didn't get involved in any bombings, I would imagine.
Oh, God. To tell you the truth, if you've got involved in loads of bombings, that would, for me, that would undermine the whole you go, girl, woman succeeding in a male world. I'd say, look, that is good, but I also want to consider if there's been any bombings, if you've funded bombings, if you've voted for wars, if you've accepted money for war criminals, if you've acted in ways that are undemocratic, we're going to have to include that in the story. But so far... We don't know if that's true. All I'm seeing at the moment is some authentic little tootsies running down a corridor.
Here I am.
Hillary, you're running again.
Well, I sure am, Karen. I just got here early for the new class we're teaching together on foreign policy decision making.
Okay, well, what are those decisions? Bomb some children, cause ISIS. Like, that also isn't a good enough joke, is it? Like, the word running primarily means to move at pace perambulated by your legs. It's not like, you know, running in that way. Yeah. It's not a surprise. It's not the sudden revelation of a previously concealed piece of information provoking laughter.
Also, the thing she's teaching is so ironic at this point.
Yeah, I'm teaching how to not blame Russia for stuff.
Classes don't start until September.
Yeah, but I wanted to be prepared, Karen. You know, when it comes to crisis situations, you've always got to be prepared.
Certainly, you don't need to be as prepared if you fucking caused them. Excuse my language.
Right. Prepared? I think you're more prepared than anyone to teach this course. Now, what are we going to call it?
Inside the Situation Room.
Annoy you just as some words inside the Situation Room. So pleased with itself. Oh, I'm inside the situation, the room where it happened. It's such a post-Hamilton, pleased with itself, liberal bit of crap.
Yes, and I'll cover the theory of political decision-making and strategy.
Mm-hmm. And I'll cover what it was actually like in the room during the bin Laden raid, the Iran sanctions, the Gaza.
What is it like to simplify that issue and epitomize all of it in the figure of Osama bin Laden when there are complex issues at stake to do with the historic clash between East and West, the representation of energy companies, gerrymandering and manipulation, the ongoing colonial impact of Western interests in the Middle East, the disruption that is caused when a military acts on behalf of corporate interests? Oh, fucking hell, get out of the room!
Sorry, I'm just going to run out of here.
Look who's running again. It's Hillary. She's running away
from the
truth.
She's running from the studio. Students, they've got questions.
She's changed into some rollerblades, inline ones, the nerd.
It's a ceasefire, you name it.
Okay, but are you ready for whatever questions the students throw at you?
Bring it on.
Okay, let's go. Here are some of those questions.
Oh.
As a supporter of the war in Iraq, what were some of your main achievements, Hillary Clinton? Was it the escalating wars, greenlighting coups, and generally maintaining and expanding power around the globe? Well, what is it? Come back, Hillary, come back. Would you say that generally you were more or less militarily aggressive than your Republican counterparts? And the answer to that, of course, is on most foreign policy decisions, including Libya, Clinton was in favor of equally aggressive action, if not more so, than former Bush appointee Robert Gates. Question, how did you package your hawkish policies publicly? Answer, Clinton and Obama got away with hawkish policies because they stuck to the language of humanitarian intervention and liberation. Clinton helped assert the right of the US government to intervene in any country of its choosing, using the most brutal means possible to achieve its end. As a mother, watch your drone policy. Clinton was an enthusiastic supporter of Obama's decision to step up the use of drone warfare in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Clinton and the Obama administration sold the drone program program as a precise and effective way to ruin weddings. Sorry, to target terrorists with fewer risks of collateral damage. But the numbers tell a different story. During 1 5-month period of an operation, 90% of the people killed in airstrikes were not the intended targets. But only 90% of them were innocent people who shouldn't have been killed. Think about that 10% who were the intended targets. Think about that and dash down a corridor all pleased with yourself to present a course on truth and foreign policy. What was your relationship with the military-industrial complex, Hillary? That's one question. God, bring it on. This is a question I'd love to see answered. What's your relationship with the military-industrial complex? As Secretary of State, Clinton made it her business to make sure the world was open for U.S. business, from securing defense contracts for Lockheed Martin to brokering deals to build nuclear plants for Westinghouse. Clinton and her ambassador CEOs traveled the globe to bring foreign governments and U.S. companies together. We have to position ourselves to lead in a world where security is shaped in boardrooms and on trading floors, as well as battlefields, Clinton said. Surely you didn't take donations, though, from military contractors. American military contractors and their affiliates who donated to the Clinton Foundation were awarded $163 billion worth of arms deals authorized by the Clinton State Department. And governments seeking to buy arms got the same preferential treatment if they sent money the foundation's way, no matter their human rights record. Clinton's department authorized $151 billion in Pentagon brokered deals for 16 of the countries that gave to the Clinton Foundation. But the main thing is that she is running down a corridor in a male-oriented world, bringing about the exact same or worse values that someone who happened to have a penis would have done anyway. Hooray! Hooray for that! Plus, I think they had a cat, didn't they, the Clintons? Yeah. That's another adorable detail.
Would it be amazing if some of the students in her class actually asked some of those questions?
That's what I'd like to imagine was happening.
Tell us.
If you're in that class, ask those questions, because anyway, we're doing that as a sort of comedically, aren't we, Gareth?
Right.
That's our dedication to comedy, because for us, comedy is more than pretending to run down the corridor, because the word run means run for office and also run down a corridor. What would be lovely, from a sensible, serious perspective, is to actually hear those questions answered. Like, it would come down to things like, well, the system is essentially set up in this way, so you have to accept these donations. Ultimately, I think the answers to those questions would leave you quite dispirited with the state of modern democracy and American globalism.
But certainly don't ask any questions about the war in Ukraine off the back of that. Just, that's the past, and what's going on now is a completely, entirely different thing.
What I like about the present is it has no relationship to the past, has none of the same players involved, none of the same institutional interests, and certainly isn't founded in the same mentality that brought about those exact problems. It's not the same businesses, companies, profit motives, everything basically exactly the same. Some of the same rhetoric, where you could literally, like that thing, where it's they take Harry Potter characters and Star Wars characters and just go, like, Harry Potter, Luke Skywalker, is met by an elder who's a bit of a mystic, Hagrid, or, you know, Ben Kenobi. Ultimately, they have to fight their father, Darth Vader, Voldemort. They go to a place to learn to become a wizard, Jedi. So you could just change the names. That's what a system means, is it operates in a particular way regardless of the personnel that inhabit it, even if that personnel's change represents a distinct, you know, bipartisan switch. Won't make no difference.
Yeah, and you can do that in the way that these days, these former either presidents or political leaders in some form, like Clinton and George Bush, are being kind of reintroduced into society and reframed as these elders who should be teaching politics to kids or doing courses on painting like George Bush has done and kind of mates with Michelle Obama.
He does nice paintings. Lovely watercolours. Mm. Like, have you noticed that? Let us know in the chat and the comments. Have you noticed how they're repositioning and repurposing war criminals and stooges of the system as a sort of avuncular, lovable, oracular elders that we're supposed to embrace and look to? Oh, the children. There was, like, because we're not super young, I'm sorry to admit, like, George Bush, that was the same as Trump. Like, they were acting like that was the issue. But after a little bit of time and a whole lot of money, they're willing to go, look, we're all in the same team, really. It's almost basically a bloody sport. And this is when something like the ongoing corruption in the world of Big Pharma becomes incredibly relevant. And we're not even talking about the craziness of the pandemic. We're talking about Big Pharma's relationship with the state, a relationship it achieves not only through making huge donations to both parties, not through the enormous amount of money that it spends on lobbying and people in Congress, Congress that own stocks and shares in the companies they're meant to regulate, but a kind of a broader mentality that it is more important to serve corporate interests than to serve the interests of ordinary Americans who are paying too much money for drugs that they funded the development of, drugs that are sold abroad at a profit by those drug companies, even when people are writing letters about family members dying of cancer for the want of drugs that cost up to $180,000 a year in the case of one prostate cancer drug.
The kicker, though, is that they're sold abroad much, much cheaper.
Absolutely, because they've been developed by America. So they're exportable and they're profitable in a way they would never be if you hadn't taxed the Americans, both emotionally, spiritually, and literally financially. To watch Joe Biden use the familial, folky rhetoric of a kind of sort of uncle in dungarees chewing on a bit of straw, kicking back on the stoop, sharing home truths with you, part of the heritage of Twain, some pastoral image of the great patriarch, and that's what we look to, isn't it? We look to our leaders as a kind of father or mother figure, some patriarch, elder, some chief, and they use the folksy rhetoric to evoke that kind of atavistic response, all the while acting as the, in this case, disgusting stooges of profiteering corporations. Have a listen to this. It's going to knock your little socks off. We'll help you get them back on again, but a surcharge. Have a look.
Too many of you laying in bed at night like my dad did, staring at the ceiling, wondering what in God names happens if your spouse gets cancer. What are you going to have? You getting money to pay for those medical bills?
Kamala Harris at the back is going, where's he going with this?
Sometimes...
Oh, is she just going to sleep in this case?
I mean, I think with Kamala Harris, I don't know what her inner life is like. Mm. I do remember in the primaries, there was a minute, unless this was propaganda, where it seemed like Kamala Harris like sort of confronted Joe Biden about, hey, your record on race issues ain't so good, and really had him on the back foot and seemed like an angry sort of firebrand woman that was really going to shake things up. But as is often the case, once in a position of some authority, her morality was usurped by expedience. At the core of the issues that we would like to showcase to you here is the figure of this dude, Beretta. Is that it? Or Bereka? Like a congressperson who, while in opposition, lobbied furiously for legislation that would prevent drug companies profiting from products that they had developed at taxpayer expense. But once he was in office, he did the exact same thing and worse. It's extraordinary, this. It just shows you again and again how these institutions use the same kind of rhetorical tricks. They blame the past. Here, what bugs me is that Joe Biden positions himself as like a kind of Martin Luther King, almost civil rights activist, fronting up to Big Pharma, when he's literally the president. He's not an outsider.
Are you going to have to sell the house or try to get a second mortgage on it? I get it. With the Inflation Reduction Act that I signed into law, we're taking on powerful interest to bring healthcare costs down so you can sleep better at night with more security.
Even right, so the idea of taking on powerful interests, that sounds like odd rhetoric for a career politician who's currently the officer, commander-in-chief of the United States of America. What offends me is the nature of this rhetoric when related to the administrative choices that are being made. In particular, we're going to learn about something called the Buy-Dole Act. Let's have a look at that now. For 40 years now, there's been a piece of legislation that means that the government can waive patent exclusivity for drugs whose research was funded by federal government dollars, speeding the arrival of far cheaper generics to the market. And yet, despite marching rights enshrined in the Buy-Dole Act, federal officials have never exercised those rights,
never.
Even as drug prices have skyrocketed. They've never used it. So what this means is if a pharmaceutical company is charging too much money for a drug, they can say, you best charge a reasonable price for that, otherwise we're going to we're going to X the patent and white label it, and everyone will be able to sell it at a reasonable price. And I won't say an obvious example of a drug that was readily and cheaply available because it was out of patent a couple of years ago, because at the moment there are no clinical trials because no one's paid for them to determine whether or not it is effective. So that's a brilliant piece of legislation. The point we're making here is, even when within the corrupt machine of government there is a piece of legislation that could be utilised in the service of people that are suffering, in this instance people who have family members or are themselves suffering from cancer, then it is not utilised, primarily because of lobbying and the amount of lobbying dollars that are spent preventing the Bayh-Dole Act being used.
Yeah, so this is when they can rescind the patent when a medicine is not available to the public on reasonable terms. And what the Biden administration are saying is $180,000 a year is apparently reasonable terms for people with cancer to be able to afford.
Seems to me quite expensive. I mean, obviously the price of life is high, but this drug called Xanthi, the Biden administration refused to force the manufacturer of a life-saving prostate cancer drug developed completely with public funds to lower its nearly $190,000 annual price tag. As Gareth says, that would seem to me to be a legit target for the utilisation of that piece of legislation. The patent holders of the prostate drug Xanthi, who's in ingredients were developed at a California public university, have earned more than $20 billion from the drug. So it's not like they ain't profited up till now. The US Chamber of Commerce spent more than $80 million lobbying in 2022. Pfizer spent $50 million, a sort of a conglomerate lobbyist group called PHRMA, or I guess they want us to say that, like pharma, spent $29 million. And Astellas, who make that particular drug, Xanthi, spent $2 million. Look at that accumulative expenditure. And what is that money about, really? That money is to ensure the government do not act in your interest, but in the interest of the industries that truly fund them and truly control them. Not all drugs are subject to negotiation. Instead, the plan will kick off in 2025.
This is Build Back Better.
I suppose that this is about, like, when you hear Joe Biden say, we beat Big Pharma this year, he is talking about legislation that will be passed to cap some drug prices. But again, this is something that when you look into it, is not as exciting as it sounds. What I've found to be the case frequently is they find a piece of rhetoric that they can use, like, we've beat Big Pharma this year, posing themselves as little guys up against corporate Goliaths. But what is broadly speaking understood is that this piece of legislation will not meaningfully impact the pharmaceutical industry, and they'll find ways around it, they'll find loopholes, and they will continue to profit.
Yeah, and this isn't new for Joe Biden either. So Biden was vice president when the Obama administration rejected congressional Democrats' demand that the government use the same power to lower the skyrocketing prices of medicine in America. So he's got history of doing this, Biden. Amazingly, when he's making those speeches about his father looking up to the ceiling and we beat Big Pharma, he doesn't then mention, oh, by the way, I'm sorry about when I was vice president making sure that those skyrocketing drug prices couldn't be meaningfully affected.
Our system requires of us a certain type of amnesia. Increasingly, we are asked not to even recall the events of a week ago in order to sustain our faith in the efficacy and legitimacy of a state that operates entirely on behalf of corporate interests, only making concessions to us when it becomes so obvious and galling that to not do it would be against their own self-interest. The Build Back Better idea, which emerged from centralist globalist force, I mean, everyone was talking about that, weren't they? Build Back Better, it's like a pandemic catchphrase, is ultimately a piece of legislation that is designed to be ineffective. This is why. Not all drugs are subject to negotiation. Instead, this plan will kick off in 2025 with a focus on the 10 costliest Medicare medicines, followed by 15 medicines in 26 and 27, and 20 medicines in 2028. I imagine that time frame is to allow pharmaceutical companies to manage their losses, invest elsewhere, find alternative drugs and treatments, and to spread the cost. Do you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of, like, when them banks went down, Silicon Valley and all that, they realized, oh no, we can't do another 2008 style bailout. That looks bad. So we're going to have to find more ingenious ways of bailing them out, because we have to protect our partners in the financial industry. And as has been explained, while there may not directly be a taxpayer bailout, banking fees will have to compensate for the losses endured by Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse and all of them. You know, we know now how these systems work. So fundamentally, what we have to demand are not incremental reforms, but radical and systemic changes. Did you have something there,
mate? Yeah, yeah. So continuing that, so the caps will be tied. So most drugs won't be affected by negotiations.
Most.
Build Back Better.
Only most,
thing.
Though.
Yeah, the caps will be tied to the rate of inflation, and the rule would apply to commercial insurance coverage too. That could ultimately entice drug makers to boost their products' launch prices. And as we have seen, in 2022, pharmaceutical companies in the US raised drug prices 1,186 times. So it's happening.
So there you are. So it's, I would say, a piece of legislation designed to grab headlines and continue to appease the pharmaceutical industry. Before we click over, we're going to have to leave YouTube now. Because firstly, I want to name that white label off-brand medication that cannot be named on YouTube. And also, what about the story about death and heart diseases and AstraZeneca and all that stuff? I can't talk about that, can I, on YouTube?
No.
I can only talk about that on Rumble. Why is that? Why is it that you're censored?
They're called community guidelines, Russell.
You've got
very aware
community.
Of that.
I'm being
it's a trick question.
I'm being naive and sweet. Okay, listen, join us over on Rumble because I've got to talk about, like, while we're on the subject of the pharmaceutical industry, why don't we talk about what was essentially their gold rush, the pandemic era, where the government and the pharmaceutical industry, some might argue, operated
allegedly
collaboratively to ensure that favorable outcomes for each were reached. Okay, so if you're watching this on YouTube, click on that link, join us. Join us on Locals if you want, and then I can read out your comments and all that kind of stuff. All right, see you later, YouTube. Rumble. Now, this is a story about young women had a 3.5 times higher risk of death from heart issues after the AstraZeneca jab. Now, this was a little while ago because the AstraZeneca vaccine, it was one of the early vaccines in the space, wasn't it, Gareth? It was one of the first out of the gates. It was known, first of all, as the Oxford vaccine. That's when we were most pleased with it. It was English. It was academic.
Yeah, and then Bill Gates got hold of it.
Of course he did. Bill's going to have a little bit. Oh, my, there's a little bit of the money in that. Let's see if we can all get involved. The Office for National Statistics analysed hospitalisations and vaccination records and death registrations in England among 12 to 29-year-olds to assess the impact of the COVID-19 jab and infection. This is from the Telegraph, which is a British newspaper, so it's well done to them for reporting on this subject, at least. And it's another example of the way that the narrative is moving. This is one of those things that when AstraZeneca, vaccine was pulled, it was right early on, wasn't it? It was like, yeah. Oh, that's a bit weird. Are they saying that it's causing blood clots and stuff? Oh, that's interesting. It was one of those things that was kind of submerged. Because literally, as I remember it, and you let me know in the chat and comments if you remember, this was at the time I was saying, get that vaccine or you're going to kill your grandma. That's when they were not only saying it was good for you, it's good for everyone. Have an hamburger, have a milkshake, have a blowjob. They were offering you all sorts of incentives to get these
I don't think
things.
That last one was offered.
Sorry, that was an offer that I was exclusively in the brand household was offering just to my wife. She remains unwilling to cooperate to this day. So after one dose of a non-mRNA vaccine, which includes the AstraZeneca jab, there was evidence of an increased risk of cardiac death in young women, the ONS said. Cardiac death would include cardiac arrest, could include cardiac arrest, heart disease, and myocarditis. That's inflammation of the heart muscle. You should know that by now. If there is a difference in the risk of death after vaccination compared to longer term, this shows a link to the jab, researchers say. Most of the young people who received the AstraZeneca jab before April 2021 would have been prioritized due to underlying health conditions or because they were healthcare workers. Therefore, the 3.5 times greater risk cannot be generalized to the whole population, the ONS said. And what was pointed out earlier when we were putting this piece together is, do you remember when we were all talking about lockdown measures and we were talking about the near imposition of vaccines? But it was imposed if you worked in certain sectors. Remember those people in New York that were kicked out of a job? Remind us what kind of pressures you would have faced to take that medication, which may have been good for you, may not have been good for you. You determine for yourselves. Remember when people were saying, oh, but aren't you noticing a lot of the people that are dying have got like comorbidities or they're obese or they had an underlying condition? Don't you remember the rhetoric was, so what? That doesn't mean they deserve to die. And I remember thinking, no, that is a good point. Just because someone's old or ill, that doesn't mean they deserve to die. That's a good point. But when it comes to addressing the impact of the AstraZeneca jab, they are pointing out that you can't generalize the results across a population because they in particular are going to negatively impact people with comorbidities. So it's another example of the way that the information is managed and manipulated. Yet another example of the from COVID with COVID. The whole way that this information has been managed in order to create the most beneficial results from those that seek to regulate and those that seek to profit. If you're trying to understand this landscape and you go, were people able to benefit by imposing regulation as a result of this aspect of the narrative, or were they able to profit as a result of this aspect of the narrative? You can normally trace a line that leads you to one of those two conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, look, with all of this, I think it's, I mean, for me, it's about the lack of access to information. I mean, even going to the Moderna case, because obviously we've had Rand Paul in Congress at the moment with the head of Moderna, billionaire owner of Moderna at the moment. He's pressing him on myocarditis and getting some more information and whether or not Moderna actually hid this information. And actually, Robert M. Kaplan, Emeritus Distinguished Professor at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, was something that we actually talked about earlier in this year, wrote that they'd found through studies series of adverse event for one in 800 vaccines, which was, a lot of a smaller amount than, or a bigger amount, you could say, than had been reported.
Numerous vaccines have been pulled for a lot less. One in 10,000, 100,000 vaccines have been pulled previously.
Exactly. But what he said was that the analysis was hindered from a lack of data being made public. So he said Pfizer, Moderna and the FDA have this data, but have kept them hidden from public view. And I guess that's the point with all of this, is just give people access to the information. You know, then they can make their own conclusions and we can have, you know, truth.
Stay free with Russell Brand. See it first on Rumble. Thank you very much. Now, having spent some time in the company of so-called entertainers and so-called radicals, why don't we invite onto the show a so-called journalist, the author of Hate Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. That's a so-called book. And also he appeared as one of Elon Musk's stooges when releasing the vital information that...
Cherry-picking.
Cherry-picked information that appeared on, when you look at it superficially, to reveal that there was some collaboration between the deep state and social media. All right, Matt, how's it going?
It's going great, Russell. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. Are you tired? Are you all right? Are you exhausted?
No, I'm good. I'm good. I was listening intently to your show there. I love the Hillary Clinton stuff. I think, isn't that a natural sitcom?
The Clintons. Like a
sort of a get a life type of thing. Like, Hillary Clinton on a bike delivering newspapers or something like that in the beginning.
Yeah. You know, rolling her eyes, her adventures and misadventures. Oh, right. Bill, what's that by your fly? Hey, what's all this dry cleaning?
And you need a Carlton the doorman character, you know, who kind of appears regularly. All that, I guess that could be, I don't know, one of the former Bob Rubin or somebody like that.
Matt, you can try and entertain us all you want, but I know for a fact, have you got more money now than when you were a little boy? Right. So where did the money come from? Corruption. How can you be a Republican witness, which is a necessary part of the congressional procedure, and not call yourself, I use this word deliberately, a terrorist?
Yeah, I mean, we're laughing about it, but in the moment, I actually made a mistake. I got so caught up in whether or not what she was saying to me was true that I forgot to just say to her, it's none of your business whether I make money or not. And you wouldn't ask that question of any other kind of journalist. Like, did you get a book deal out of this story you're telling us about? I mean, nobody would ask that question normally. So that was absurd. The way they all use exactly the same phrases when they talk to you is incredible. In the case of that hearing, I think you're referring to, you know, the cherry pick, spoon fed evidence. I must have heard that a million times since the beginning of the Twitter files.
What I imagine must be interesting about an experience appearing at that congressional hearing is that something that, for me at least, usually feels abstract, like corruption, the way that information is manipulated, smearing of opponents. Like sometimes we encounter these things, sometimes we're even personally subject to it. But to actually be within the machine, did it make somehow more visceral, personal and emotional your broad sense that there is entrenched corruption taking place?
Yeah, it was a little bit of an eye-opening moment for me. I mean, I've obviously been doing this for a long time and seen a lot of crazy things in my lifetime, so I'm not surprised when politicians are corrupt, but it was very shocking the degree to which they didn't even think about engaging with the material. It was just pure attack, attack, attack from the very, very beginning. And then, as you noted, every time I tried to answer a question, it was just reclaiming my time. You know how this works. You don't get to talk over and over again. And like, that was a little shocking.
Yeah, I suppose the danger is that if it were not a subject that I were personally invested in, I wouldn't inquire. And yet what is revealed is the MO of the institutions, that it presents itself as an objective and investigative process, when in fact it's a propagandist and condemnatory process that's, in a sense, designed to help us reach the favorable conclusions that it has already predetermined, as evidenced by the use of the phrases like spoon-fed and cherry-pick. They already have an agenda. They don't listen to you. They smear rather than investigate. And I suppose this must be happening continually elsewhere and is symptomatic of a deeper malaise that won't be as easy to observe elsewhere. As the ongoing Twitter revelations continue to be released, do you feel that at this point it's just further augmentation of the ideas of corruption that were sort of present in the first imprature, or do you feel that it's sort of evolving? Is there anything like new and interesting, and how does it relate to things like our personal deal over here at Rumble, where we're subject to some attacks? And sometimes I feel like, oh well, yeah, I guess there are a lot of people that are right wing on this platform. That's kind of difficult to deny, and also that is allowed. People are allowed to be right wing. That's one of the things people are allowed to be in the world. And what do you think about the sort of TikTok congressional hearings? And because they seem to also be sort of like an odd combination of utterly inept and biased and corrupt, because all the things that are being alleged of TikTok are applicable with the American state's relationship with US social media sites.
Yeah, I mean, we are still finding stuff that speaks directly to all the things that you're talking about. For instance, we found a whole bunch of communications just recently about in preparation for a hubbub they were all having at the Aspen Institute in 2021, where they were discussing ideas like the Restrict Act, which is being proposed for, in response to TikTok. There's, I guess, the European Digital Services Act or whatever they call it, that they're thinking about for the EU. All the ideas in both of these bills are sort of wish lists that have been passed around in this community for a long time. The governments want absolute, full and complete access to all data that these platforms provide. And then they want a couple of other things that are really important. They want to have the authority to come in and moderate, or at least be part of the process of moderation. And they also want to for people who are called like trusted flaggers. That's how it's described in the European law. They want those folks to have access to these platforms as well. And that what they mean by that are these sort of outside quasi-governmental agencies who tell these platforms what they can and cannot print about things like vaccine safety, right? And then we found out more about that, where they're openly talking about censoring true information. We're still finding out a lot of stuff about this, and I think there is more to find, unfortunately, which is kind of disturbing.
I've not heard a maxim more disturbing lately than a trusted flagger. If someone comes to me claiming that they're a trusted flagger, I think I'd be more at ease with someone who announced themselves as a paedophile. It just sounds like a disturbing thing to call yourself or to set up.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. I mean, but that's in there. That's in the Digital Services Act. If you look at the bill, there's a whole list of things that would apply to the various different types of companies, and one of them is sort of access for trusted flaggers. Twitter has its own language that's similar to that. They have people they call trusted partners who determine for them, who are allowed to make determinations about content, or whose determinations they will take seriously. So yeah, I mean, this is all it's straight out of 1984, all this stuff. The the language, yes.
This is my time. I'm reclaiming my time. This is my time. How dare you? How much money did you make during that time you were talking just then? Where did you get it? You and that bastard Schellenberger, a dangerous, dangerous, stinking terrorist, and you don't wash properly either, I don't imagine. Thanks. It was good fun, wasn't it? I said I was going to do it at the beginning of the show, and then I thought, I'm not going to do it because I respect Matt too much, but then I thought, no, it will be funny, so I did do it. That was my process. But, hey, the EU apparently are introducing legislation that means that what was covert is now becoming sort of overt, where they're sort of saying, platforms like Rumble, we're just going to shut them down and ban them from EU states, which doesn't include Britain anymore, as a matter of fact, so, you know, to hell with them. But, like, it's interesting, isn't it, that they are essentially just going to legislate against free speech because they have to. And one of the ways they can do that is saying that free speech is a code for racism or hate speech or whatever. And of course, there is such a thing as racism and hate speech. But what we continually say is we want to use these platforms to tell the truth and attack powerful institutions and also to have the ability to speculate and have fun and joke and all those kind of things, but not really to hurt people. I hate the idea that someone would be hurt as a result of my words. So what do you think? Do you think, Matt, that we're going to see more and more overt legislation and maneuvering to shut down the ability to communicate openly in the way that these platforms facilitate?
Absolutely. That's one of their primary goals, is to make it impossible for people to have unfettered communication. If you look at the Digital Services Act, it's a lot like the recommendations of the Aspen Institute, and it's got a lot in common with the Restrict Act here in the States. When you look at the sections about giving the government access to data, what they really mean by that is they want everything, every kind of content that's created on the platform has to be done in a format that can be algorithmically searched. So even video, or if you have, like, you know, something, a conversational platform, they have to be able to automatically generate a transcript quickly so that whatever AI they're attaching to surveil and monitor people has to be able to look out for keywords quickly. And it's funny, we did a thing about this thing called the Virality Project, and they were upset. One of the things they were upset about when they were reviewing COVID information was that a worldwide freedom rally that was held last year, I think, or 2 years ago in Europe, had been organized on Telegram, where they couldn't search it, where they didn't know it was coming. And so, like, that's part of their thinking. We don't want any more of those spaces where we can't search. We want everything searchable, and we want it instantly searchable.
So it continues to be about control, and they continue to present it as about safety. We're trying to protect you has become, it is actually, we're trying to control you. When you say that about AI and a kind of pressuring to put data into searchable formats, it makes me feel that AI will of course be used to generate commercial opportunity by creating very particular and bespoke advertisements, but also it's going to be utilized to exert more control. And while it might start as a resource that's accessible to all and fun for everyone, it will quickly, like water, find its level as a tool of commerce and of the state. So there is a, in spite of however they frame the problems within platforms like TikTok or Facebook or Rumble, free speech has to be a kind of absolute principle, because the alternative is predicated on a centralized authority. And when you see even terms like cherry pick and spoon fed starting to emerge, or, you know, build back better, it's that these are the indicators that centralized authority is at work. And like you said, those various bills all bear the same hallmark. So you have to have some absolute principles, don't you, Matt?
Yes, I think so. And I think what's really striking about all the people who are backing these censorship measures is that they have absolutely no understanding of what the principle of free speech is all about. The whole idea that you could have a centralized sort of truth deciding authority is completely counter to every Enlightenment idea about what speech is for. Like, you can't have a government body that decides fact and fiction. We don't believe that that's actually possible. What we believe is that people freely discuss things and they arrive at a kind of truth together. Factual truth is always a moving target in journalism. But as a society, you can't just decide what's true and what's not true, because as we learn, even scientific fact changes constantly. So if you don't allow free speech, if you don't allow weirdos and people who are crackpots to have their say, you know, because they're right a lot of the time. Like, you just never know, right? And the folks who want to get rid of all of that are deluded and extremely dangerous people, because what they believe is that they have all the answers. Like, we're the experts, we know, and, you know, never mind what you think, yeah. Which is terrifying.
Their certainty is terrifying, and certainty is often an indicator of the psychopath, I would say. Matt, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on the tremendous work you're doing. Thank you for enduring that awful experience and doing so with such good grace and good humour. Don't berate yourself for not saying it's none of your business, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Who made you Lady Jesus? Was it Hillary Clinton? And thanks for being such a great asset for our show and a great person to work with. Cheers, Matt.
Of course. Thanks, Russell. Have a good one. Gareth, take care.
Oh, cheers.
Take care, mate. Matt is the editor of Racket News on so-called aggregating news site Substack. Thanks, you lot. What a lovely man.
He's so great, isn't he?
Isn't he decent? See how, like, little things like saying your name, what that's an indicator of is principles, values, awakeness. So that's a person who's kind.
And the way they branded him in that hearing was disgrace. And what's so ironic at the moment, literally listening to you two talk about, I guess, authoritarianism is what we're talking about here, is Biden and Trudeau, literally the other day, uniting together against authoritarian regimes, you know, when they kind of met. And it's so mad that they can be like, we're just against authoritarian regimes. Oh, what about all these things that are going on at the moment? No, that's different.
Don't ask that question. We'll have you killed. Don't you ever call me an authoritarian. This is my time. This is my authority. Our authoritarianism is couched in a different type of language and weird, odd, perverted victimhood. Hey, thank you so much for joining us on today's show. Tomorrow, our guest is Callie Means, a whistleblower. He blows whistles, who exposes corruption in Big Food and Big Pharma. If you saw him last time he was on the show, he was fantastic, talking about a new obesity drug that's set to be the most profitable drug in the world. You could check that out on Rumble now. It's already up, but we're having a deeper, longer, stronger conversation with him a little later. You should sign up to our locals community, because you get my Brandemic stand-up special free as part of the deal over there, as well as ad-free content, access to a weekly show that me and Gareth do called Stay Connected, meditations, podcast. I mean, there's so much stuff on there. I literally don't have time to list it all. Not when we are so busy. Please join us tomorrow, not for more of the same, but for more of the different. Until then, stay free. Many switch in, switch on, switch off, switch on. Many switch in, switch on, switch off, switch on. Many switch in, switch on, switch off, switch on. Many switch in, switch on, switch off.